Our scripture reading this morning is taken from Genesis chapter 18, verses 1 through 15, and from chapter 21, verses 1 to 7. And I read from the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. This is the story of a son being promised to Abraham and Sarah. The Lord appeared to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre as he sat at the entrance of his tent in the heat of the day. He looked up, saw three men standing near him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent entrance to meet them and bowed down to the ground. He said, "My Lord, if I find favor with you, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree. Let me bring a little bread, that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you've come to your servant." So they said, "Do as you have said." And Abraham hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, "Make ready quickly 3 measures of choice flour. Knead it and make cakes." Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the servant, who hastened to prepare it. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he'd prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree while they ate. They said to him, "Where's your wife Sarah?" And he said, "There in the tent." Then one said, "I will surely return to you in due season, and your wife Sarah shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent entrance behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I've grown old, and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure?" The Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too wonderful for the Lord?' At the set time, I'll return to you in due season, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. And she said, and he said, "Oh, yes, you did laugh." And following is the story of the birth of Isaac. The Lord dealt with Sarah as he'd said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he'd promised. Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age, at the time of which God had spoken to him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to his son, whom Sarah bore him. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Now Sarah said, "God has brought laughter for me. Everyone who hears will laugh with me." And she said, "Who would ever have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age." May the Lord bless this reading from his holy word.
After putting their 3-year-old child, Brian, in bed, his parents heard muffled sobs coming from his room one night. Rushing back in, they found that the child was crying hysterically when they saw him. He told his parents that he had accidentally swallowed a penny, and he was absolutely sure that he would die now. The father, in an attempt to calm him down, quietly took a penny from his pocket and pretended to pull it from Brian's ear. The child was thrilled and stopped crying at once. In a flash, he snatched the penny from his dad's hand, swallowed it, and then cheerfully demanded, "Do it again, Dad!" Parenthood is much like this. A mixture of comfort and frustration, patience and sorrow and joy intermingled. Which is why, when they were told they were going to be parents, Abraham and Sarah, who the Bible describes as old, so much so that the Bible wanted to stress it again and said it again, they were advanced in age, that Sarah's response is to laugh. Laugh and say one of those things that I'm not sure you heard it the first time. One of those things that you're not sure that they said in the Bible. After I have grown old and my husband is old, shall I have pleasure? This is long before the little blue pill, and God's response is to laugh and cough and go, I don't think you should say that. You know, they're writing down these stories. She, of course, means the pleasure of childbirth, which at any age is anything but. Though you can imagine her and Abraham wondering how they're going to baby-proof a tent when for 100 years they've lived a completely different way. We have that same feeling when we go home. Our parents are not 190, but we have to go out of our way to tell our parents, you know, you can't have the crystal bowl right at baby height. That doesn't work. That's not good baby-proofing. And they stare at us with Sarah's eyes as if we're declaring the impossible. This declaration of the impossible, the hoped-for birth of Abram's and Sarah's child, this story as it's shared from Genesis isn't the first time they've heard it. Before this, with both Abram and Sarah at 190 respectively, God declares that they would be parents to generations, that they would be in fulfilling the covenant that God's promised them. They would be sources of life for the generations that would come. In the story, though, we overlook the fact that Abram previously had a child with Hagar, his son, Ishmael. But it's like that secret doesn't exist in biblical times because really blended families weren't talked about much. But the fulfillment of this impossible dream that is presented and shared with them doesn't overshadow Sarah and Abraham's life. They go back to being people of faith, people they were created to be, gracious and hopeful people. When sitting in their tent, sitting by their tent, Abraham sees three people and offers aid and hope. Many of you know that I just came back from a trip from Israel, Palestine, and during our time there, in addition to walking where Jesus walked, we deeply considered how he walked and with whom. We considered how, as Jews and Christians and Muslims, shared our generational connection to Abraham, how we share and those that live in the land, how they share this very holy land, and considered how we're not called to squabble over our inheritance like children. We considered the groups of marginalized people which have filled the land over generations, people hurt by war and division, people in need of healing. In part of our work, we visited with mission and service partners, saw where your donated dollars were at work, and shared important conversations about faithfulness and life in the midst of suffering. Some of the days were back-to-back conversations, which emotionally drained us and left us waning in our ability to listen and to care. Such was the case one day when two people entered the room, joking and laughing with each other. They seemed thankful to be with us, grateful for the opportunity to share their story, and some of us were just happy for the lull in between conversations to grab a tea or coffee and caffeinate ourselves up for the next conversation. But as they sat and shared that they were representatives of the parents' circle, a group formed of both Palestinians and Israelis that have lost loved ones to this unending conflict, we realized that we were entertaining angels unawares. They told their stories of loss, of husbands and fathers and children caught up in the crossfire, their faces drained of the smile lines and the light that shone on them when they entered the room. Instead, we saw comfort and frustration and patience and sorrow and joy intermingled. For as Rami, an Israeli father who shared his story of his daughter's death, who died because of a suicide bomber in Jerusalem, as he shared his story, he touched a part of us that resonated. He said his first reaction was rage. Anger is very powerful. It sweeps you away. But then I started asking myself questions. I knew that killing someone would not bring her back, and I knew that causing pain to someone else would not ease my pain. So as a rational person, you start to look for answers. Why did it happen? How could such a horrible thing take place? What can cause someone to be so angry that he is willing to blow himself up with a 14-year-old girl? Amazingly, we didn't see rage. Nor did we see a man crippled by grief, overshadowed by lingering doubt or despair or dreams unfulfilled. As Rami told and shared his story of as a helpless father, he looked over to his Palestinian partner who accompanied him that day and who shared her story with us. And in them both, we saw hope. For as the conversation went on, they called each other sister and brother. As Rami tells it, his grief and sorrow and search for answers led him to the parents' circle, the family's forum, and he remembered that first meeting as if it were yesterday. I watched the people getting off the buses, bereaved Palestinian families coming towards me, shaking my hand, hugging and crying with me. It was a complete shock, and it changed my life completely. I was 47 years old, and for the first time I had ever seen Palestinians, not as workers in the street, not as terrorists, but as human beings. Abraham's mercy to the three who came near the entrance of the tent in the heat of the day was not because he believed them angels. He saw their humanity, their human need. He humbled himself as a servant to them. He offered to bring water and bread and offered them a chance to wash their feet. I've walked through that land now, and before I never understood the importance and the profound gift of the beauty of washing your feet at the end of the day. Oh, mercy, I did it every day and prayed over those burnt and bothered little toes, but it was such an amazing gift. And when I read that this morning about Abraham offering that to those who have journeyed, that is life-changing. Water and bread and hope and life. Abraham offered these gifts in the same way that Rami offered the gifts of his story to us. We tried to understand the journey on which he had come, to understand the pain which seems to be written on the DNA of these peoples. But what came through was hope. Whether it be through the commitment of peacemaking or simple offerings of water and bread, they're gifts that speak to our common humanity that we share. And we struggle as people to see that common thread that unites us. We struggle to see in each other a neighbor or a friend. We hesitate to care for others because it seems like there's not enough to care for ourselves. We have a hard time having patience. Good Lord, I know the number of times I've said prayers for patience as a father. Because we struggle to have that patience for those we love, let alone those who are outside of our circles. My stepdad, some of you know that my parents split at an early age, and my stepdad came into my life when I knew absolutely everything there was to know about humanity. I was in my teen years and had the whole of the universe figured out. Or at least I thought I did. I didn't need a father. When my parents split up, I was blessed with a few father figures, my grandfather particularly, and people in my life that taught me and challenged me. And though it was a few years in between my parents' separation and my stepdad's arrival, I made it clear he wasn't needed. I wasn't kind. But it's wonderful how time makes fools of us all. Because as the years passed, as we were lucky enough to own a home, whenever something broke, the first call was to him. And he'd pass on wisdom, sips of water to a thirsty soul, crumbs of wisdom to feed my own learning. He could have sat by his tent and let me suffer. He could have brought up to mind those days when I was less than kind. He could have shared dreams destroyed of caring for a know-it-all teenager. But to this day, he embodies comfort and frustration and patience and sorrow and joy intermingled. And so on this day, on this Father's Day, I give thanks for fathers like my stepdad, for Rami, who we met in Jerusalem, for Abraham, who stood by his tent and offered to serve. For in the many ways that we have experienced fatherhood, we give thanks for those who have sought not to be perfect, but instead sought to bring hope in difficult situations. I give thanks for those who have inspired generations, and it's why I close this sermon with a poem by Rudyard Kipling. I ask for forgiveness for the gender exclusion. It was written at a time when that was not a thought, but this is a poem entitled, If. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting. Or being lied about, don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating. And yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone and soul hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. For we are challenged to seize this moment, the 60 seconds of grace that we're allowed, to give thanks and live and love with hope. Amen.